Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of Philosophy podcast. So on this podcast, I am going to be exploring all sorts of different philosophical issues. I'm mostly a technology journalist. That's how most people know me. I've been doing the Voices of VR podcast since May of 2014. I've recorded well over 1,000 different interviews about virtual reality. But the thing that I notice is that the deeper that I dive into the issues of virtual reality, the more I come up into these fundamental philosophical discussions, like what is the nature of consciousness? What is the nature of reality? And philosophers have been talking about these questions for hundreds of years. So I wanted to go and speak to the philosophers themselves. I have a broad range of interests, and I try to take a very holistic approach. Virtual reality, it's this interdisciplinary melting pot between all these different disciplines of game design and architecture and aesthetics and storytelling. And so I've been forced in some ways to come up with my own philosophies for how to make sense of how to combine all these different things together. And so there isn't a lot of journalism that happens in the realm of philosophy. And so my approach was to try to ramp up and learn the language, and I ended up doing about 27 different interviews and about 14 and a half hours of conversations over the 4 days of the American Philosophical Association Eastern Meeting. And bit by bit, start to unpack both the context of people are about to talk about, and then provide my own takeaways about what I got out of these conversations, not only philosophically, but also commenting on the sociological and anthropological and institutional dynamics of the philosophical community itself. So the very first interview that I did was with Louise Williams. At the top of the conference, there was a session called the Moral Parity Argument Against Panpsychism. So panpsychism is one of the philosophy of mind theories. There's a fundamental question, not only in philosophy, but all of science, which is, what is consciousness? What is the nature of consciousness? And there's a variety of different philosophical approaches to this question of the nature of consciousness. And so Zach Balesi was looking at more of a meta-ethics argument. So trying to look at morality and the different analogs between morality and consciousness and making an argument against panpsychism. And so Louise Williams was a commenter arguing in favor of panpsychism. And there was also another commenter that I also did an interview with as well later on in the week. And I actually also talked to Zach. So this was a good case of what happens at the American Philosophical Association is you have somebody present a paper, and then you have a couple of people who have different comments about that paper, and then they have like a little bit of a debate and then an open question and answer period. So that's what we're covering on today's episode of the Voices of Philosophy podcast. So this interview with Louise happened on Monday, January 9th, 2019, at the American Philosophical Association Eastern Meeting in New York City, New York. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
My name is Louise Williams. I am a fifth-year graduate student at the University of Notre Dame, and my main areas are philosophy of mind and Buddhist philosophy.
Okay, great. So maybe you could talk a bit about what was happening here at the APA conference and the session that you were in, and a brief overview of what type of things were being talked about there.
Yeah, so the APA conference generally is like the National Organization for Philosophy, and tons of different philosophers from all over the country are here, some from international places as well. And I came here specifically to give comments at a session on panpsychism. So the topic of the session was, there was another grad student that was presenting an argument against panpsychism. And he was basically arguing that panpsychism's logic is kind of weird. And if you accept the logic in the case for panpsychism, you also have to accept this weird metaethics theory. And like the metaethics theory, no one really wants. So that shows that we shouldn't go for panpsychism. Yeah.
And so for me, I almost would consider those things potentially completely different things, because consciousness could be something that's emergent from our brain. It could be something that's fundamental. It could be like a fundamental property of the universe. And we don't know in terms of morals and ethics. So what was your comments or your reaction to this argument?
Yeah, so I had a similar reaction to it. In the paper, the author's kind of suggesting that the two things are very analogous, like what's going on with consciousness and kind of what he wants to talk about in metaethics. He thinks that they're similar enough that we can get his two arguments off the ground. I don't really think that's the case. It seems like metaethics is pretty different. And specifically in his paper, the issue is what moral properties are. Properties are a really complicated thing in philosophy. There's like the metaphysics of properties. This is a complicated conversation. But basically, he needed moral properties to be pretty similar to consciousness in order for his argument to work. And I kind of think at the end of the day, those are pretty different things. And if he's going to convince me of that, he needs to do more work in order to get that going.
Yeah. And I guess this is one of the biggest open questions in science, also the philosophy of mind, is what is consciousness? Is it something that is a fundamental field? Is it something that every single photon and quark has a certain level of consciousness? Maybe you could give me a brief overview of the landscape of different options that we have in terms of like the philosophy of mind.
Yeah, so the biggest issue probably in philosophy of mind right now is like, what is consciousness? So for a while in analytic philosophy, which is the dominant kind of philosophy here at this conference, people were convinced that consciousness was just purely physical. It was just like electricity in your brain. It's just your neurons firing. That's the whole story. Anything else people are talking about is just wishy-washy. They just aren't thinking hard enough, basically. Since we've kind of moved away from that period where thinking physicalism can kind of respond to every problem, there's big issues trying to get consciousness this way. Most importantly, most people don't think of consciousness as that. We tend to think of it as something very fundamental. So alternatives have been like panpsychism that, well, maybe we shouldn't throw out physicalism. Maybe we shouldn't say like, it's all just soul stuff, right? So that's one way to go. And the question of what is consciousness is to go for dualism and say like, okay, we got physical stuff and then we've got your soul, and consciousness is just a feature of your soul, or maybe just is your soul. So it's real and very different. That view is a little bit hard because how does the soul interact with the physical stuff? Maybe hard to go. So panpsychism tries to go a different route and say like, okay, so we really do have the physical stuff, but the consciousness, that stuff is built into the physical stuff. So we actually have little bits of consciousness in the most basic physical stuff that we have around. So you get the view that like electrons and maybe quarks actually have a little bit of consciousness in them. But of course, any plausible form of panpsychism isn't going to say that like your dining room table actually has consciousness. It's going to say like you only get consciousness the way that humans experience it when it's arranged a certain way. So your table doesn't have feelings. You don't have to worry about kicking it. It's because it's not arranged the right way. You got to get the right arrangement to get things like pain or sorrow. All that stuff doesn't come with the table, but there's little bits of it in there.
And so it seems like one of the arguments against panpsychism is the combination problem of like, how do these individual bits of consciousness in every single photon or electron or piece of matter, how does it combine together to have some sort of coherent, emergent consciousness? It seems like a similar issue with perhaps physicalism in some ways, or maybe you talk a bit about the combination problem within panpsychism.
Yeah, so the combination problem is a very serious one for panpsychism. And in general, philosophers today don't agree on how to respond to this particular problem. So the problem's been around for a long time. William James, actually, at the turn of the century, he basically started talking about this issue where it's like his idea was you get a bunch of men, like line them up in a straight line and tell each one to say one word of a sentence. And you'll say a complete sentence at the end, but no person had the whole sentence in their mind, right? Like you were going bit by bit. So how do you actually get like the whole kind of experience coming from these little bits? So the problem's been around. There have been some proposed solutions to it. In my opinion, the responses to the combination problem are not very compelling. I think if panpsychism and if more broadly atomistic views, so atomistic views are just anything that say like all the fundamental stuff is in the little bits and we just build up the little bits to get the larger thing. Atomistic views are all going to suffer from the combination problem to varying degrees. It's not such a problem when we talk about like physics, because it does actually work out if you like arrange electrons the right way, get them with the little stuff. You know, we get things like tables and chairs. But because consciousness is so different, it's really hard to see how we're going to manage that particular problem.
Well, I think it also gets into like ontology and epistemology in some ways. If you look at, do we only exist in a physical world that's spatial and temporal, or is there some sort of platonic realm of ideal forms that's non-spatial and non-temporal, non-local field that maybe consciousness is hanging out there and it's interfacing with reality in some way? And to me, it feels like it could be a similar argument for mathematical objects. Maybe they are non-spatial temporal. Are they actual real or not? And Aristotle had formal causation, which has some doorways open to have, like maybe these mathematical objects are somehow mysteriously interfacing with the fabric of reality. And if that's the case, then what would prevent consciousness from being able to actually interface with reality as well? But then the argument against that form of idealism, I guess, is the Platonic epistemology, which is, well, if there is this mathematical objects in a realm that's beyond space and time, then how do you know? How do you actually interface with those objects? And so it seems to me that it becomes a philosophical issue, because if it is non-spatial temporal, it's beyond the realm of empiricism, so you can't actually do any tests around it, which I feel like is a bit of the challenge around consciousness, is that it kind of gets relegated to the realm of philosophy, because how are we going to ever really know?
Yeah. So, this is there's a big debate, because philosophy of mind in particular wants to engage in empirical science to some extent. We, like, philosophers aren't conducting the actual experiments, this kind of thing, but they are, like, reading what neuroscientists are saying. And they're trying to keep track of how psychologists are thinking about the way, like, babies learn to see things. And, like, there is this interaction. But some philosophers, like, very adamantly think this is the wrong kind of thing for philosophy to do. Like, philosophers are doing a totally different thing than what you're doing in the empirical sciences. And philosophy, like, if it happens that your view matches what the empirical sciences are saying, like, that's nice, but it's not really important, because the empirical stuff is coming from maybe some bad assumptions, or they're not being very clear about what they're studying. I mean, I think that the best solution when trying to understand consciousness is kind of go like this interdisciplinary route, where, like, there's definitely some space where, like, we might have a philosophic view, we might be able to have some empirical ways to kind of see if it's even plausible. I don't think the empirical stuff is going to help us tweak every little bit of how we're understanding consciousness, but some people do think that future science might be able to.
Yeah, and it seems like that just taking an argument like panpsychism and saying, well, that doesn't logically make sense for how these things would combine together, it seems to me that there's a certain degree of making argumentations and using the method of logic to be able to describe things that may be beyond the realm of logic. I mean, if consciousness is in some sort of non-spatial temporal realm that is non-local, then how could we use something that has a very specific sets of logic from what our understanding of the world is be applied to something that we can't even actually understand the fundamental basis of?
Yeah, so there's a good question about, like, how maybe transcendent are we allowed to be with consciousness? So people who are trained in analytic philosophy especially, right? There's two major branches of philosophy today. There's analytic philosophy and continental philosophy. Analytic philosophy, like, tries to be kind of more mathematical, very precise. We're giving, like, really clear definitions about every single thing we're doing. Usually analytic philosophers are very resistant to go towards anything being, like, beyond the realm of reason. They think that, like, if we can just be clear enough in our terms and, like, we can get everybody on the same page, we're really going to be able to, like, give an argument, and arguments are really powerful. That's their view. Continental philosophers tend to be a little more skeptical of that. They're not sure you can tidy things up, because experience is really complicated, and it's hard to think that we can, like, isolate everything and get all these people to think of the exact same thing, the same phenomenon, and give these kind of arguments. In the history of philosophy, there's been lots of times where people have gone kind of more the transcendent route, or maybe historically people have appealed to things like God, maybe something supernatural, to kind of point to, like, this is actually pushing the limits of our reasoning abilities, and we kind of need to accept that. I think the contemporary version of that is, like, well, we should try to use our reason as much as possible, but we need to be open to the idea that, like, maybe reason's just not going to take us there.
Yeah, to me, I look at metaphors from artificial intelligence, because there's a similar split in the sense of, like, there's symbolic logic and there's a computer program that someone is going to write, and that's coming from the mind. It's very algorithmic. It's explainable. But then there's machine learning algorithms, which are basically a neural network architecture, and that you are curating a set of data that then you are letting the AI experience. It has inferences that are built in based upon the labels that are given to that, but then the AI architecture is able to discern through all of that, and it's able to make judgments based upon that. And so, to me, it feels like the human brain and our experiences are very similar in the sense that we have a rational part of our mind, but that we also have this sub-symbolic intuition and experience and emotion in our bodies and our perceptual systems that are somehow aggregating all these things together and making sense of it based upon some sort of interaction between the category schemas and the models that we have of the world, but that there seems to be some mysterious combination of those two things, of our mind and our logic and this other more experiential phenomenological dimensions of taking in all this input data, having these experiences, and then from that, having certain intuitions and beliefs based upon that. And to me, it doesn't seem to make sense to completely eliminate that intuitive aspect and say, well, let's just use logic to describe the nature of reality.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think a lot of analytic philosophers would push back and say, like, well, I just don't know what those other things are, right? Like, so they might be skeptical that there's something to intuition that's very substantive. I mean, philosophers in general do appeal to intuitions, including analytic philosophers, but it's like often in when you're doing moral philosophy, right? You like, we all have this intuition that like, killing someone is wrong. Like, we have this kind of gut feeling. In ethics, intuitions play a big role, but it's not clear what those are. And sometimes we have empirical studies that show somebody saying, like, my intuition is this about this moral claim. It doesn't hold cross-culturally. So it's like, okay, well, like, this one group of people has this intuition, but, you know, if we go to sub-Saharan Africa, it looks really different. So the way people try to use it is like, okay, I can't quite with reason explain what this intuition is, but it is clear that most humans think this, and then they run their argument, but it turns out it's hard to make those kind of conclusions. So I think in general, analytic philosophy has a hard time understanding what the role of intuition should be, and some want to just dismiss it because they can't, you know, put it in that nice crisp little definition that we're like really striving for.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could recount a little bit of Daniel Dennett's position on consciousness, because he seems to take a bit of a eliminative materialism perspective to kind of say that all of it's a bit of a perceptual illusion, that it's just neurons firing, that there's nothing else more than that.
Yeah, so Daniel Dennett is a very popular philosopher to read, especially in philosophy of mind. He's written some books that are on the New York Times bestseller, but he's often not super well understood. One of the big things that's difficult in Dennett's view, so like broadly, he's somebody who thinks that there really is no difficult question about consciousness. All we have is like our physical stuff, and that's kind of the entire story. So he thinks we're kind of something like, he uses this example of Gilbert, the storytelling robot. So this is a robot, it goes around the world, it's able to move around, it records events, and basically all this robot does is output a story that explains what the robot did. Dennett thinks we're just like an organic version of Gilbert the robot. There's nothing special about like who we take ourselves to be, what our perceptions are like, what our actual experiences are. He thinks we're just kind of believing this weird lie where like everything is focused on, you know, like it seems to me or it feels like. And he recognizes that everyone reports that like that looks blue to me, or I feel cold. He recognizes we all speak this way, but he thinks we should sort of take the perspective of an anthropologist and be like, okay, so these people are reporting that ghosts help them tie their shoes. They believe that, this person believes that, but as an anthropologist, all you do is you write that down and you say, yeah, that's right. This person believes that. You don't take it as evidence that there really are ghosts helping you tie your shoes. So he thinks this whole project of phenomenology, this whole kind of experience, the things we're puzzling about in consciousness, we're just like deeply confused. And the answer is just, we're all physical stuff. Please stop talking about it.
Yeah, well, it seems like that panpsychism is something that is an old, old idea, but it's, being recast. Did this come back with like Alfred North Whitehead, or what is this reclaiming of these ideas that you could maybe talk about as a form of idealism or all is mind and maybe Neoplatonism? But, you know, what are the differences between like this panpsychism and idealism and maybe a bit of the history of the evolution of those ideas?
Yeah, so panpsychism was definitely kind of dismissed within analytic philosophy for a lot. Analytic philosophy is not that old. It kind of starts around the time of William James and Bertrand Russell, these kind of characters, early 20th century. So panpsychism was like really dismissed. In fact, the encyclopedia online, which is the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, that's like the authoritative one because it's peer reviewed. Its first entry on panpsychism was like total trash. It was just talking about how stupid this view was, and it was a total like mistake to ever think about this. But it's become much more popular now as we've kind of really hashed out all the problems with thinking that consciousness is purely physical. So basically, we've been puzzling hard about like, how do we figure out consciousness? And we're like, oh, science is so powerful. Physics is so helpful. It's got to be physics. And we just like go really hard into that. And we're like, there are these problems that just can't fix. And now we're desperately looking for other choices. Now, one other choice would be go like full idealism. Idealism has been around in many forms for a long time. And it's been around the world, right? There's a form of Buddhism called Yogacara Buddhism that's often understood as a form of idealism. It's not just a Western thing. Within the West, there are lots of early modern philosophers that are giving flavors of idealism, ranging broadly from everything is an idea in God's mind. So it's not like my mind is creating all of these things, but it's God's mind, and God is the constant. And that's why we have objective reality, because it's all being held in God's mind. So you have views like that down to more modest things, which are more like, you know, I am kind of creating these things as a product of my mind, and you give different explanations for why there's objectiveness. Now, idealism has this problem where it doesn't put a lot of emphasis on the physical world, right? Because the physical world could be pretty different if the ideas that we generated were just different. So idealism hasn't been palatable as a popular view in analytic philosophy for a while because we've been so focused on science and on physical stuff. Physics seems to answer so many questions. It's got to answer these key questions. So, okay, idealism's a little too far from what, like all the good stuff we think from physics. Panpsychism is kind of a middle ground. We get to keep some of the stuff we liked about physics. We get to have the physical world is still really important in panpsychism. In fact, it's more important than it might have been in a lot of different options between these. So panpsychism looks attractive because we get to keep some of physics and we don't have to go as extreme as idealism. But the benefit of idealism is like consciousness makes a lot of sense because your mind is doing like all of the activities. So we get to bring back some of that central role of the mind. And it looks like we kind of get to hold both of the good things together.
Yeah, what I found interesting is that in the mathematics community, there's actually a lot of people who openly call themselves Platonists or mathematical realists. But it's a confusing term because they don't go as far as just saying everything is just, you know, mind or one universal mind or God's mind. But usually I've heard it universal mind rather than putting some sort of like religious context of God. But if there is this universal mind and that there's a product of materiality that is emergent from that mind in some way. And I think that quantum mechanics, in some ways, there's a lot of open questions in terms of what is actually happening at the quantum level. There's a lot of weirdness that are happening. And then maybe, you know, what is the boundary between observation of the subject of making the observation and what is happening out in the rest of the quantum system? And if it is quantumly entangled, then what if the human mind is a non-local conscious observer and in the process of making a quantum observation, then whatever that mind is observing and looking at then is somehow potentially collapsing the quantum wave function. We don't know if that wave function is actually collapsing or not, but mathematically it's showing either we're spreading off into an infinite number of parallel worlds, like in an Everett model of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, or there is some mechanism by which that quantum wave function is collapsing, and it could be human consciousness that is the mechanism by which it is collapsing it. And if consciousness is a fundamental field, then you have this most direct evidence that I've found in any sort of other sciences of saying there's this anomaly that's happening in quantum mechanics where we don't know what is happening with the quantum measurement problem. Consciousness is also really weird. Are those two things happen to be combined?
Yeah. So quantum physics is definitely like a popular thing to kind of bring up in these conversations in philosophy of mind. As it turns out, there are not a lot of professional philosophers that also are very good at understanding what quantum physics is. There is a field, the philosophy of physics, that kind of toys more directly with some of these things. But I definitely think that quantum stuff, more than previous models that have been popular in physics, really is starting to push the limits of kind of just the physicalist view. And it really is starting to look like things just aren't as simple as that kind of picture, which consciousness seems like it could explain a lot of different things. But one reason for that is because it's so unclear what consciousness is. So, I mean, it's a little bit dangerous because you're like, this thing's mysterious and that thing's mysterious and these must be connected. But on some fundamental way, it seems compelling because these things do seem to be importantly related.
Yeah, and you also mentioned the Buddhist philosophy, and I'm just really struck by how panpsychism has been dismissed by the analytic tradition of philosophy for such a long time. Maybe there's this bias towards this pragmatism and naturalism. We're kind of really denying anything that may be mystical or spooky or anything that is related to some sort of non-spatial temporal realm. But yet, within the context of Eastern philosophies and Buddhism, this seems to be a part of their culture for a long, long time. And so maybe you could talk a bit about how you're studying the philosophy of mind, but also looking into these Eastern traditions and how they may be looking at some of these concepts like panpsychism.
Yeah, so non-Western philosophy is kind of a hot topic in academic philosophy right now. I actually started doing Buddhist philosophy as an undergraduate and have continued through graduate school. So I know the most about Buddhist philosophy, mostly of the Indian philosophic tradition, but there's a whole lot to say about Chinese philosophy, and there's probably also some good stuff in African thought and maybe South American thought. So I can speak a little bit about the Buddhist tradition that I know about. When you're working with a non-Western tradition in general, it's very complicated when you want to look up something like consciousness, because we seem to kind of in the West sort of mean the same thing when we say consciousness. They mean something totally different in non-Western traditions. So in Buddhist thought, it's actually very common to think that there are multiple consciousnesses. So panpsychism has like everything as a little bit of consciousness. Most Buddhists aren't going that far, but they're going to say like, well, we normally have six consciousnesses, and that's usually the five senses. Each one of those counts as a consciousness.
Is that a kosha?
Is it a what?
Is it called a kosha?
So it varies. Some of these ideas are common between Hindu thought and Buddhist thought, and it goes by a lot of different names. Like a popular one is the skandhas. It's related to the skandhas. Buddhists in general are trying to do kind of like this, I mean, depending on the flavor, but in general, they're kind of going over this reductionist strategy where they're like, oh, you think, you know, you have a self. Let me break that down. And they show you that, like, really your question is going to be, okay, so what actually is the self? What do I point to? And the Buddhist is going to go through a bunch of arguments and show like, hey, you can't find anything. There's no candidate reference. So one school has tried to resolve some philosophic problems with this kind of account when it comes to like deep forms of meditation. So like, you know, the monk goes into the cave, he's going into a really deep state. It looks like he's not moving for days, but he's not dead. Like, what's happening to that guy? Because he kind of seems to be somewhere else, but he's also physically here somehow. So they have this thing called the foundation consciousness. This is the Yogacara Buddhist school that's sometimes understood as a form of idealism. And they kind of say this is the foundation to everything, and this flavor of consciousness is not introspectively accessible. So we can't like think about it and feel our foundation consciousness. This underlying thing kind of gives rise to all the other stuff. All of our ordinary experiences come from this, and like how we actually experience stuff depends on the contents of that basic consciousness. So the way I understand this form of Buddhism is actually kind of flipping what's going on in panpsychism. So panpsychism says everything has a little bit of mind, but Yogacara is saying actually the big category is mind. And then there's lots of little bits in that, right? So it's a holistic picture rather than an atomistic picture, because the most important thing is that foundation consciousness rather than the most important thing being the little tiny bits of mind.
I often hear Alfred North Whitehead be brought up in the same breath as panpsychism, because he has his process philosophy and he's getting away from saying that things are this physical stuff, but it's more about relationships of connections and relationships of patterns of energy or things being connected to each other. But why is it that Whitehead is connected to panpsychism in particular?
Yeah, so process philosophy is kind of a complicated entity. Whitehead is definitely usually associated as one of the founders of process philosophy. And he is, well, one of the reasons, right? And so in process philosophy, everything is kind of like evolving. We're like part of this creative thing where we're like bringing in, and like everything is kind of a process, right? That's where that name is coming from. Everything is a process. It seems like some of that creative energy and stuff that's going on in process thought is related to kind of the mental activities, like the things that are going on in consciousness. So it's a pretty natural way to understand process philosophy as kind of putting this fundamental, like, important thing is consciousness generating all of this stuff. And a natural way to do that is through, like, consciousness is actually in all the little bits that are composing all the stuff.
Interesting. And for you, what are some of the biggest open questions that are really driving your work forward in philosophy?
Yeah, so one of the things I'm really interested in is this relationship between atomism versus holism. So I think that holistic approaches to consciousness are actually better than the atomistic approaches, but like science doesn't look a lot like the whole, like they, science generally takes an atomistic approach. I think we might actually be able to do empirical studies in a more interesting way if we took a holistic approach, but that's something to lean into in the future. So I work on that issue, and I'm also really fascinated by issues surrounding the self. So one of the things my dissertation is focusing on is understanding the self as a narrative. This is a view that Daniel Dennett also kind of promotes. He has a view called the self as a center of narrative gravity. So if we go back to Gilbert, the storytelling robot, right? He kind of thinks that like, oh, look, Gilbert wrote a story. That's all we are. I think that that's a little bit wrong. I think that the problem with Gilbert is that all he did is make a bunch of sentences, and that doesn't actually reflect our phenomenological experiences. So I think we should move away from this model of like bunch of sentences to understand like what a narrative is and thus understand what the self is. Instead, we should look to things like movies and storyboards. These are things that have a lot of phenomenological experiences. That's like a critical thing to what a movie is, right? You sit down, you look at a screen, you have a whole bunch of visual stimuli, you've got a whole bunch of different audio experiences. All of these things play into what's going on. I think that the self is actually more like a movie than it is like a novel, where like movies have some dialogue, there's some language, but it's not like the defining feature of what a movie is. So I'm trying to develop a view where we can understand the self as narrative, but in a narrative that's something like a movie rather than just like a novel.
And you had mentioned properties, and it seems like when you talk about something makes you feel something, then I guess it begs the question as to whether or not that thing that you're feeling is an inherent property of that thing that you're actually experiencing. Like, is it somehow a part of that? Like, are you tuning into something that's deeper about that object, maybe some sort of archetypal dimension of that experience? And so is that part of the philosophical debates as to that line and that boundary between whether or not these phenomenological experiences that we're having, is this just something that is coming from our own lived experiences that is referencing from our own memories and our own direct experiences, or if there's something deeper in terms of properties of these qualia that may be embedded within these objects as well?
Yeah, so in analytic philosophy, it's a popular thing to try to figure out, like, what are, like, the necessary properties? Like, what are the features of a thing that's, like, intrinsic? So if we took away those properties, it's no longer that thing. Versus just, like, optional properties that we have, maybe accidental properties. So there's a bit of a struggle in how to understand phenomenological experiences because they can vary. It looks like the kinds of experience you can have when, like, you're looking at a TV versus me. Like, if you're colorblind, like, even though there's the same stimuli, there's like, so then it looks like, well, maybe the color aspects aren't necessary to the experience. But that looks kind of weird, because if the TV is actually showing us blue and only one of us is experiencing blue, we're starting to worry about what's going on. So a lot of discussion in philosophy of mind is trying to figure out, like, what properties do we need to worry about and which ones do we not? This is one of the things I think is an advantage for holistic approaches to consciousness, because there's like the fundamental thing, which is consciousness, and then all the other stuff is less fundamental. You just call all the other stuff properties of the fundamental thing. So then we can kind of give a property theory of like everything about our experience, where the most fundamental thing is like our stream of consciousness. That's where all the action is. And then all this other stuff is just properties of that. So we can sort out the world a little bit more clearly if we go that way.
Well, it seems like that philosophy within itself is a bit of a story of trying to make sense of the nature of reality, and that the philosophy will help inform the empirical scientists to know where to look to go find something. Like, as just an example, the atomistic versus the holistic view of consciousness. If you believe that there is a more of a holistic vision of this, you know, maybe universal mind or idealism or something like that, then that may be actually changing where the empirical scientists are going and how to even start to try to describe an ecosystem approach or an organism or a philosophy of biology, you know, trying to take something that's more of a series of relationships between things rather than something that's an atomistic approach. So it seems like the philosophers in some ways are driving through the philosophy of science and also through the philosophy of mind what the actual empirical neuroscientists and other scientists are actually doing their day-to-day job.
Yeah, so that is the ideal situation from a philosopher's perspective, that we both have views about what the empirical sciences should be directed towards and the scientists are listening to us. It doesn't always work out that way in real life because, I mean, philosophers don't always spend their time reading science articles and scientists often are not reading the philosophers. That's why I kind of think it would be advantageous for analytic philosophy, especially, to go for a more interdisciplinary approach. Because consciousness is a really complicated thing, and philosophers have been trying to puzzle about it on their own, kind of, and that isn't totally panning out. So I think having more substantive conversations between the two, like, for example, I wrote a paper about issues in the philosophy of perception, where I think meditation actually can help us to see things as they truly are. And one result of my view is that scientists should actually meditate. And that's because they'll be able to collect more objective information, because rather than just react when they get a visual stimuli and start labeling it and try to understanding it, they'll be able to like take a moment and just see what it is and then process it. There's some empirical research to support that meditation can kind of impact this, but those guys weren't talking to philosophers. So they asked some kind of weird questions in their research, and the result has kind of been like, it's not so clear anymore exactly what empirically is like speaking to this philosophic point.
Yeah, it's interesting that I'm also finding that there are these academic silos of all these different disciplines, and that because I'm covering virtual reality, that in some ways is this cross-disciplinary melting pot from all these different disciplines to start looking at things. And I feel like there's a lot of implications of the philosophy of perception, the philosophy of mind, that may be able to start to empirically test by creating a common direct experience that multiple people can experience, and it'll be the exact same experience. But there's, I guess, that can only potentially go so far in terms of getting to the ultimate nature of consciousness. I'm not sure if VR is going to be the magical silver bullet, but one thing that I do see that's happening is that it's able to both create a new tool epistemologically for research to be done, but also it's popularizing a lot of these philosophical discussions that have been happening for hundreds and hundreds of years. Now, all of a sudden, it's crossing the chasm into the mainstream so that people are able to start to ask these questions of like, wow, this felt just as real as this other experience that I can label as real. Then what is reality? And what is the nature of consciousness? What is the nature of reality? And that VR is kind of bringing up all these fundamental epistemological and phenomenological questions.
Yeah, no, I think virtual reality is a really important thing for philosophers of mind, especially to pay attention to, because it does really, in some ways, it kind of tests out some of our ideas about how perception works and about what like the actual experiences are. Because like in the past, we've talked about things like hallucinations, and for a while, we liked talking about people on LSD. That was popular in the 60s. So like we have a few examples like this, but virtual reality is kind of like a controlled environment where we could actually like look at what's going on, and like philosophers without risk of the negative side effects of LSD can like actually generate these kind of experiences and see like if their views actually map on to what it's like to walk into this kind of fake world.
Great. And finally, what do you think is the ultimate potential of philosophy and what it might be able to enable?
Well, I think philosophy is most important because it trains people to think systematically. So whatever kind of problem you're facing, whether it's a puzzle at work or whether it's a personal puzzle, whatever it is, the skills of philosophy are good because they'll help you systematically figure out the best way to approach that problem. I think ultimately philosophy is probably a little bit more like art than it is like science, but I think it's a really important expression of the human condition. So I think it's important that we're doing these kind of projects in philosophy of mind today because virtual reality is just starting. And even though like maybe in 100 years, virtual reality will be so common that people will be like, oh my God, what did Louise think about that? That was totally wrong. Like that's okay because I'm like giving this expression of what's happening in my world today. And that's really significant, even if I never produce, you know, that the answer is 1,204.
Great. Is there anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say?
Well, thank you so much for having me do this. It's really fun to talk about philosophy to non-philosophers. It's also fun to talk to philosophers, but there's something special about non-philosophers that I like.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks.
So that was Louise Williams. She's a fifth-year graduate student at Notre Dame, and she was giving comments on Zach Blessy's paper on a moral parity argument against panpsychism. So I have a number of different takeaways about this interview. Is first of all, well, to me, I don't think I could have started on a much more hot topic than the philosophical take on consciousness. And it's something that I've been personally interested in for a long, long time. And so it was fun to talk about some of the nuances and the varieties of different philosophy of mind perspectives. And so I also found it was interesting that there's a split between continental and analytic. And I think that was a dynamic that a lot of analytic people within the philosophical community see that, okay, there's these two options. But to me, that's a little bit of a false binary and eliminates how there's a lot of non-Western traditions. And one of the things that Luis was advocating for was this interdisciplinary approach to consciousness. And I think that's exactly right, that it's so complicated and nuanced that you really need to have many different disciplines that are looking at some of these fundamental questions. And, you know, it was fascinating to me that she's talking about the three major approaches to consciousness that are looked at through the analytic tradition. So these are the things that are actively being debated, where you have physicalism, property dualism, as well as panpsychism, in that there's problems with each of those and that there's none of them that actually have a clear answer. But there's also like this interface between the empirical scientists, who tend to be a little bit more on the physicalist side. The neuroscientists aren't necessarily testing these panpsychic ideas. I don't even know if they are testable specifically, but just that there's this kind of interface and dialogue between the assumptions that the empirical scientists have to make, because they're saying that this is the basis of reality. They have their own philosophy of science that is taking care of a lot of those metaphysical assumptions. And so a lot of times the scientists aren't even talking about metaphysics at all. And so they're only looking at what they can look at through their tools of science, which is much more of a physicalist approach of looking at what you can see through the lens of neuroscience. But there's still that fundamental question of like, how does all of our perceptual input get integrated and synthesized into this phenomenal experience? There's a TED Talk that David Chalmers gave a number of years ago talking about the nature of consciousness. And to me, that was a really powerful talk, because, you know, Chalmers was doing this public philosophy where he was trying to reduce down the complexity of these debates. And Chalmers was the one who really popularized that there's this hard problem of consciousness of, you know, how do you actually come up with this phenomenal experience out of these fundamental independent parts of all of our perceptual input. And so he kind of coined that term of the hard problem of consciousness. And then Daniel Dennett is like, well, there is no problem. It's all physical, you know, stop worrying about it. And he's taking a real eliminative materialist approach to it. And so in the TED Talk by David Chalmers, Chalmers was actually like, hey, you know, we actually need really radical perspectives like Daniel Dennett. That's a very radical perspective, that everything is just physical stuff and that your consciousness that you're experiencing is just a big illusion and that it's not actually real. And that another equally radical approach is this approach of panpsychism. It's just to say that, you know, there's little bits of consciousness in every bits of matter. And there's other theorists like Tononi's information integration theory. So to me, these issues of consciousness start to pull in all these very interesting other strands of the philosophy of science, the philosophy of quantum mechanics, the nature of reality. Is there a transcendent realm of ideal forms that goes beyond space and time? Or do we live in a naturalistic world where there is nothing that is transcendental? So it's also interesting to hear that Louise Williams is looking at these different Buddhist approaches of looking at consciousness, because one of the things that we didn't talk about is idealism, that maybe the analog of if everything is just physical stuff, well, maybe that's the opposite. Maybe everything is just mental stuff and there's one universal mind and everything that we're seeing is some sort of illusion of reality that we're perceiving. But at the core of it, that's these patterns of energy related to each other. And Bernardo Kastrup is somebody who really is advocating for this idealism approach of the universal mind. But that's not necessarily something that is seriously being considered within the analytic tradition. But I would just point out that the non-analytic, non-Western traditions of Buddhist philosophy, Luis is talking about the Yogacara tradition, that tends to have a little bit more of the holistic universal mind perspective. And the last thing that I'd point out, the takeaways, is just the properties and the elusive nature of properties and how philosophers talk about properties, but didn't necessarily want to dive too much into the weeds into properties, because that seems to be a very specific philosophical thing to try to define what those are and to see how philosophers are using properties. But it's something that came up throughout the course of the conversations with other philosophers and talking about properties. And so hopefully we'll be able to unpack that a little bit more as I go through some of these other conversations. So that's all that I have for today. And I just wanted to thank you for listening to the Voices of Philosophy podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a supporting member of this podcast. This is a completely crowdfunded initiative where I'm relying upon my audience to be able to support this type of public philosophy, taking a little bit of a different approach, which is to try to go into the context of the American Philosophical Association on their terms and to be able to have a variety of different conversations with these professional philosophers. And to best I can, through the use of natural language, being able to talk about these different concepts, because I found that whether I talk to mathematicians or philosophy of mathematics or virtual reality or artificial intelligence, if I go to a professional conference and just start asking questions, then I can start to learn enough about that knowledge domain to be able to carry on a conversation that's allowing them to have the full expression of all the things that they want to talk about. Now, I think there's limits to that because there's obviously going to be these different philosophical concepts and ideas that are embedded within the language that they're going to use it. And so that's at least my approach. And so if you enjoy this effort of public philosophy through the Voices of Philosophy podcast, then please do become a supporting member. $5 a month is a great way to support these initiatives. If it's successful and that there is a market for this, then I can continue to bring you this type of coverage. So you can become a member and donate today at kentby.com. That's kentby.com. Thanks for listening.